Hello, I'm Thomas Curtis. I'm a reporter for the Sydney Wired team for 2SER Radio. 2025 marked the first year starting with The Wire. At first, it was a little daunting, but as the days and months went by, I gradually settled in and discovered the joy of sharing these stories. As 2025 comes to a close, I would like to share with you my top 10 favourite stories that I have produced for The Wire this year. Some of these stories taught me something new, some were fun to make, others were serious, and a few were very close to my heart. So I'd like to ask you all to sit back and enjoy listening. Coming in at number 10 is Deep Listening to the Sounds of Nature. In this story, we explore the practice of tuning in closely to the natural world and how this mindful listening helps us connect more deeply with the environment around us. The term is called deep listening and it's been used for thousands of years, both here in Australia and across the world. To understand more about this concept, I spoke with Monty Nixon, a PhD candidate at the University of Canberra, who explains a little bit more on what deep listening is.
So deep listening is a relatively new term to me as well. I've been working with a fellow, Andrew Skiosh, who's been sort of working with this term a lot more. But we've kind of come together to talk about deep listening as a process of really just slowing down and trying to slow down our brains and just actually open ourselves up to hearing the different patterns and voices that we can hear when we're out on country with nature, different birds, animals, and just trying to really not just hear the sounds, but actually spend some time trying to understand what the conversation is going on around us.
And for anyone who is interested in doing some deep listening in nature, what is a good natural environment to do it in?
Really anywhere. I'm sitting in the backyard at the moment. I can hear the magpies and the rosellas and the cockatoos having a bit of a conversation. But I think the key is going to a place that you might not get distracted. So that might be wandering into a space where it's just you as a human and you've got the opportunity to listen to everyone else around you talking, having conversations. So that would be my recommendation.
Coming in at number 9 is your microchip for your pet could become functionally useless. This was one of the more bizarre stories of the year. Across Australia, pets registered with a company called HomeSafe ID, a microchipping company, were suddenly at risk of losing their information, making the microchip functionally useless. That's because the company announced it was ceasing trading, and with that decision, all the information linked to those microchips could be wiped, leaving thousands of pet owners in limbo. I spoke with Dr. Bronwyn Orr, veterinarian at Southern Cross University, who explained what this problem could mean for pets and for their owners.
It means that while the microchip will still work, each microchip only contains a unique number. It doesn't actually contain any other information. While the microchip will still work, the database that it's linked to, in the case for hundreds of thousands of pets that have microchips from a company called HomeSafe ID, are at risk of essentially not working anymore. When a vet or a shelter scans your pet's microchip, it's not going to link to your information anymore because the registry appears to have ceased trading. And the website administrator is threatening to take down the database, which would make all that information disappear.
And what type of risk will this pose on all Australian pets?
It means that pets that have the HomeSafe ID microchip that that is registered to this registry. I estimate there's likely hundreds of thousands of pets that are affected because RSPCA Queensland used to be a part owner of this company, and these chips have been inserted into tens of thousands of shelter animals, breeder animals over the years. What's going to happen is that if these pets ever go missing, if they get lost, perhaps they run away in a storm or whatever the case is, when a vet or a shelter or a pound scans for their microchip to find out who owns them, it's not going to link to anything.
Coming in at number 8, a rise of cyberchondria. Many of us have moments of being worried about our health, but in a world where AI is developing and we are all becoming reliant on the internet, those fears can spiral out of control. More and more people are turning to Dr. Google, ChatGPT, and social media platforms for answers, and instead of reassurance, they often find themselves panicking. This is called cyberchondria. I spoke with Dr. Kathy Andronis. She's a GP, psychotherapist, and the chair of the RACGP Specific Interest Group in Psychological Medicine. I asked her to describe the condition.
Cyberchondria is a modern term, really, for saying that people go online and investigate their own health symptoms. Often can become very preoccupied with trying to get information about what's happening to their health through the internet rather than going conventionally through the medical and health system.
Dr. Google is a major big component of cyberchondria. It is my understanding, apart from being a GP yourself, you're also a psychotherapist. How many patients do you see with this condition and what have you observed?
Well, it's a very common condition to various extent. Every day I see people who have done quite a bit of research on the internet about their health condition, about their physical health symptoms. Some people use it very wisely and go to reputable sites that have got a good evidence base behind them, and it can be really helpful for them to sort of have some basic understanding about their health, including some very good lifestyle measures about managing problems. However, there is a proportion of our patients, probably I would say at least 10 to 20%, who spend an excessive amount of time going down rabbit holes on the internet looking for the most obscure or the most non-evidence-based forms of advice about any symptom that they may have.
Coming in at number 7, the post-school slump after finishing school. Finishing year 12 is a very big milestone, but for some it can create some challenges and uncertainty about their future. I spoke with Dr. Sarah Jefferson. She's a director of the High Achieving Teachers Program at Edith Cowan University, who explains what kind of challenges students face after finishing school.
For most students, the thing that they really struggle with is that loss of structure. Suddenly, you know, they're not going to a familiar environment every day, not seeing the faces they used to see, the people they used to interact with. So I think that's one of the biggest challenges they face, is that just their whole life looks completely different to what it did for the previous 12 to 14 years.
And how can they set like some sort of short-term goals to sort of help prevent that sort of post-school slump?
That's such a good question. I think one of the things that applies to fully fledged adults as well is when you've gone through something that big, it's really important to give yourself a bit of permission to have a bit of a slump, to feel a bit uncertain or you know, questioning or a bit flat, and to allow yourself to feel those feelings and acknowledge, yeah, that is okay. I think the thing that is important is that doesn't go on for too long. So you have to have kind of a little bit of a time frame around it. And then you know, that great metaphor about getting back up off the mat. It's time to get back up off the mat.
Coming in at number 6 is South Australia struggles with algae bloom. This was one of the most serious stories I did on The Wire. South Australia was hit by a harmful algae bloom that spread across its shores and coastlines, leading to the death of marine life. The impact went beyond the environment, tourism and local businesses, from restaurants to surfing and snorkeling operators were also affected. To capture the scale of this issue, I spent the day speaking with business owners and environmental groups, gathering their perspectives on the issue. In the end, I spoke with 3 people.
At the moment, we are really, really a bit cautious about the quality of the product. Like, as a industry we are working in, we need to make sure we are really on top of the quality. And just because of the algae bloom, it's just like, you know, like we haven't encountered any problem as per our suppliers, but it's getting a little bit challenged. If you see the raw, it's getting a little bit expensive and we just need to be more cautious.
I mean, here hasn't been a severe effect. I guess we've been on the marina, we're probably not as affected by the, I mean, it has been a bit quieter this week, we noticed, but I mean, probably for the school holidays as well, ending compared to last week.
This is a devastating impact on Australia's incredible marine environment. We're very concerned, as are people in South Australia and all around the country. This algal bloom has already caused significant harm to the marine environment and also to coastal communities. And so, yeah, it is of the utmost concern to all of us.
Coming in at number 5, landline phones making a comeback as customers lose trust in their telcos. In an age dominated by smartphones and high-speed internet, a surprising resurgence is emerging, the landline phone. After the disastrous Optus 000 outage, many Australians began to lose trust in their telco providers. For some, that meant turning back to the landline as a source of reliable communication. Once considered obsolete, these phones are now finding popularity even among younger people. To understand this shift, I spoke with Carol Bennett, CEO of the Australian Communications Consumer Action Network.
I think with recent outages, particularly with 2 in the past couple of weeks, consumer confidence has really been shattered, particularly in the 000 system. And people want to know that when they are hit with an emergency, they're going to be able to call 000 and they'll be able to get through. And clearly, this ongoing sort of discussion and debate around whether the 000 system works or doesn't work, and in what circumstances you need to have it, you know, an app to back up your access to emergency system or a landline, or whether you need to have multiple providers. I mean, these have all been ongoing discussions in the Australian community in recent weeks. And I guess the issue is we really need to shore up confidence in the system that's there rather than ask consumers to make a workaround, because it shouldn't be up to them to have to try and ensure that they can access 000 when they need it.
Coming in at number 4, volunteers remember the Sydney Olympics 25 years on. This year marks 25 years since Sydney hosted one of the most memorable Olympic Games in history. And it wouldn't have been possible without the thousands of volunteers whose dedication and energy helped make the Games what they were. I spoke with Rosemary Muller, one of the volunteers who shared her memories of giving her time during Sydney 2000 and reflected upon the experience.
I was very lucky that I had a hero who was a Brazilian dual gold medalist in the triple jump, and he actually spent the games with us. He came as a mentor for the Brazil team. And on the night that Kathy Freeman ran the 400, he was invited because we introduced something called legends, and whatever final was on that night, they had a legend that had previously won a gold medal, and they were introduced to the stadium. So I was able to take him to the stadium, and I was invited into the Games family area to watch. And of course, he came out because it was a triple jump final that night. And the 400 meter representative was the great Juan Terena from Cuba, the man who used to run in long white socks. So I got to meet him, I got to meet Al Urta, and this is all before Kathy ran and won her gold medal. So that was a night for me to remember.
Coming in at number three is John Laws passes away aged 90. This story is one of the closest to me, as I've always had a deep connection with Sydney's commercial radio ever since I was a teenager. In this piece, we pay tribute to veteran broadcaster John Laws, known as the Golden Tonsils, who passed away at the age of 90. His voice was a fixture on the airwaves for 70 years, right up until his retirement in November 2024. To reflect on his remarkable career and legacy, I spoke with Dr. Dennis Muller from the Centre for Advancing Journalism at the University of Melbourne, who offered a meaningful perspective on John Laws's impact on Australian broadcasting.
The fact that he was a pioneer of talkback radio, he was very early on to it, that he sort of set the template for it, this combination of the strong voice, the combative style, the attempt to influence politics. These characteristics, which I think have become part of what we understand by talkback radio, were to a large extent invented by Laws. He had a very big national audience, but his really crucial audience was in the western suburbs of Sydney, because that is a very large population. A lot of people of not very well off, a lot of powerless people, and he gave them a voice. He would stand up for them. He would take on government departments. He'd take on big corporations like the banks and the airlines and so on. And he became a kind of folk hero, particularly in that part of the world. And that part of the world, Western Sydney, contains a lot of very important, very often marginal federal electorates. And so that gave him real political clout, because his capability to connect with people was a tremendously strong political asset. And people like Paul Keating when he was treasurer, John Howard when he was prime minister, they wanted to borrow some of that. They wanted to borrow some of that credibility, some of that ability to connect with people. And so they were always clamoring to get on the Laws program.
Coming in at number two is living with dementia as a migrant can mean losing a sense of identity. This story is especially close to me, as I helped care for my grandmother through dementia for about a couple of years. But as for migrants living with dementia, the experience can feel like losing a part of themselves. Many forget how to speak their native language, reverting to the way they first learnt it as a child. In that process, a sense of identity and belonging can fade. I spoke with Dr. Farhad Hanna, Associate Professor in Public Health at Torrens University.
Obviously, as you know, that dementia impacts areas of the brain that is responsible for thinking, for memory, or even things like everyday function. So the condition can lead to multiple issues and health issues, including the way you think and the way you talk and the way you remember things. So one of the things that happen is that language that is acquired later on in life, and I mean after your very first language, which was learned during infancy and childhood, so that language is pretty much well protected. But the languages that were learned afterwards and acquired afterwards, such as what happens when you migrate to another country and you adopt a new language to survive, obviously, is actually impacted quite heavily.
Absolutely.
So what happens is a bit of stripping of that sort of second language, if you like.
What unique challenges do culturally and linguistically diverse families face when navigating dementia care systems, which can be very difficult, right?
Well, it's very difficult to navigate anything in terms of health issues for those who are culturally and linguistically diverse. due to barriers, you know, cultural barriers, language barriers, ethnic barriers, in some cases religious barriers, and the understanding of health and disease is different from culture to culture. And in Australia, we have so many different cultures, melting pot of so many different cultures, and that's all beautiful. And integration and coming together as one nation is a fantastic concept.
Coming in at number one is Minecraft Mayhem. This is one of the most unusual and fascinating stories I ever covered for The Wire this year. A viral trend swept cinemas around the world. It was known as the chicken jockey trend. Moviegoers joined in by cheering loudly and tossing popcorn, drinks, and even bizarre items like toilet paper, flour, and fire extinguishers. And the most interesting moment of all was when a live chicken made a special appearance as well. Dr. Sophia State is a humanities lecturer at the University of Tasmania. She wrote an article about this in The Conversation.
Initially, I think it was just a reaction of excitement when Jack Black's character says the words chicken jockey. People were saying it alongside him in the audience of the theatre. And it just kind of, it escalated from there. And as you have alluded to, it has got a little bit out of hand in some cases. But I think in a majority of cases, it's just that shouting out the words, clapping, cheering, and occasionally a bit of standing up.
Tell me, what are your thoughts on why this is happening? Is it like, apart from social media, what is exactly fueling it?
I think that this is a real expression of joy and of feeling seen by young people. And by feeling seen, I mean they're being acknowledged by the film itself, but also they're being seen by one another and they're acknowledging one another. So I've described it as being a social thing rather than an anti-social thing. And that's what I mean by that. They're kind of identifying themselves to one another as members of this community that exists around Minecraft. And especially in the early days, you know, you really had to be in the know. Now it's been talked about by people like me, no doubt making it uncool. So it's spread kind of beyond the community. But initially, I think it was really a way of young people just identifying to one another, hey, I'm part of this community as well.
And that concludes my top 10 Wire stories for 2025. Thank you so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed revisiting these stories with me. If you would like to go back and listen to those 10 stories again, go to thewire.org.au. The Wire will be on hiatus from December 1st until February 2nd, but we look forward to having you join us again in the new year. On behalf of the entire team, I'd like to wish you a Merry Christmas and a Happy New Year. And may your 2026 be filled with joy, success, and positivity. Thanks for listening. I'm Thomas Kudus.